Well, hello and welcome to the Tim Masso podcast. Today we have a very special guest from Garrick Watches in Norfolk, UK. This is Dave Brailsford. Dave, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you, Tim? Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Now, entrepreneurs from Britain in the watchmaking space like Stephen Forsey and Peter Speakmarin, they started in Britain, but they ultimately commercialized their efforts in Switzerland. So why did you choose England?
Strangely enough, before we continue, those two guys both trained under a good friend of mine, Peter Roberts, who's a very well-known British watchmaker. And that's how I first got into this industry via Peter, believe it or not. It all stems from literally, I was at a show with Peter, Silent QP, when Silent QP was still going. And I was kind of, he just launched a watch at the time called the Concentrique. And I was on a stand with Peter, and then who's now my partner, Simon, he approached me and wanted me to start up a watch brand with him because I was consulting at the time and I knew the industry. And for like 6 months, I said, no, I don't want to do it under any circumstances, knowing the many pitfalls. And I gave it a lot of thought and I thought, well, you know what, if we start up, we've got to do something a little bit different. We've got to try and go in-house as much as possible. And that's kind of how it all started. And literally Simon had a existing facility in Norfolk. He was a 30-year watchmaker. He had an existing workshop. So we invested in new machinery, things like that, a new plant. Took us about a year of development. And then we literally updated the workshops. And that's kind of where it all stemmed from. It was all back in 2013. And that's why we're in Norfolk in the UK. There really was nothing at the time. There was only Roger Smith kind of doing in-house watchmaking. And everybody else was importing from Switzerland, which is the norm, obviously. And we just wanted to do things a little bit different. So we started with dials and then we went on to making our own cases and everything else. And it's just been a learning curve the last 8-9 years.
It seems right now we've got a lot of interest in horology in Britain on a larger scale. Yeah, you've got Braymont, you've got Roger Smith still in the UK. You've got Garrick, you've got Charles Frodsham.
Struthers as well, yeah.
Just a lot in all parts of the UK, Scotland, Ireland, we're seeing this generally. Is this a new golden era for British watchmaking?
Yeah, absolutely. It was kind of non-existent a few years ago. It's all stemmed from the last 4 or 5 years, really. And it's really, like I say, it was pretty unique 8 years ago. There was nothing at all. But you've got a lot of people now that are starting watch brands, and obviously they haven't got the money or the resources to kind of go in-house, but then you've got the old school watchmakers that have seen successful brands like Peter Speak, Stephen Forsey, and other British watchmakers, and they kind of want to emulate that, and that's where it's all stemming from. The only difficulty is for a lot of British watchmakers is they train and they all go into the swatch service centres and things like that. So they don't really necessarily learn too much on the engineering side. And if you're building your own watches, you've got to have that engineering knowledge. And that's what takes years and years and years. It's quite a complex business when you start making dials, movement bridges and all that kind of thing. But there's, we get approached all the time by, and we never did years back, we get approached all the time now by British watchmakers that want to learn and want to do it properly. So it's putting British watchmaking back on the map, which is a good thing.
Without a doubt. I think it's interesting you mentioned that people want to come train with you, because I know a lot of folks who've set up brands have said that training watchmakers and perpetuating the trade is a big part of why they're doing what they're doing.
Yeah, it's difficult, because the problem with us is we'd love to take more people on, but frankly we just don't have the time to train anybody. That's the issue we've got. And we get quite a lot of people approach us. They come out of watchmaking schools and then they want to do all the engineering side, and it's time consuming and we just don't have the time to do it. But we'd like to change that, and we're working on that at the moment. But there are some really cool watchmakers in the UK doing some unique stuff, and don't get me wrong, there's some fantastic brands. You don't have to be a watchmaker as such. There's some brilliant British brands that are importing watches from parts from Switzerland and Germany that are doing some absolutely fantastic designs. And that's the good thing about dealing with independent watchmakers. You literally get something unique. It's not like you go to Basel Worlds. You know yourself, every year everybody does the same thing. It's tourbillons 1 year, jumping hour the next. It doesn't work like that with independents. Independents have always got something unique to offer. And that's kind of, I run the Watchmakers Club in the UK, and there's quite a few independent brands on board with that. And that's what it's about, just promoting what we do, really.
So now, you started a brand in 2014, and there was already a fairly large independent scene back then. So you must have had a very specific idea of what you thought was missing in the watchmaking space. Why did you see the need to start a brand?
Well, you had, at the time, there was quite a few brands, not as many as there are now, but there was Schofield at the time, Giles doing his unique pieces, Pinion had started up, there was quite a few, but we just wanted to go down the in-house route. Like I said earlier, really, I would have never done it. I gave it thought for, I'm sure it was 6 months I thought about it for, and Simon kept harassing me. David, have you made your mind up yet? And like I say, I've worked with watchmakers over the years as a consultant, and I knew how difficult it was. I mean, don't forget, Brand, even Peter Speak, 15 years before he made it big, and a lot of other independents struggled for years and years before they actually hit the big time. And I knew how difficult it was. And, you know, I gave it a lot of serious thought. And like I said earlier, and then I thought to myself, listen, I said to Simon, if we're going to do it, we've got to do it right. We've got to invest in machinery. We've got to try and do as much as we can in-house. But at the time, we had really nobody to ask, and we were, a lot of the stuff we were doing earlier on was prototyping for the first year. So we actually, the concept came about in 2013. We spent a year putting the workshop together, buying the machinery and everything else, and then the 2014 was really a year of development, working on dials and all that kind of stuff. And then you know, and then when we were ready, we started launching with the main model. At the time was the Shaftesbury and the Hoxton were the first two models we ever did. And then it was the Norfolk, but everything's been a learning curve for us. And that's the difficulty we've had as a brand. We've been trying to do things ourselves without too much prior knowledge. Simon was trained at Waspet, and he trained under Peter Roberts, the same as Peter Speak and the rest of the independents. So, he had a good background. And then our main watchmaker, which is a guy called Craig Baird, he's a master watchmaker. He was already on board with us, but again, so they had a lot of engineering knowledge, knew how to use the lathes and everything else, but it's it was a difficult time for us the first 2 or 3 years, and that's why I didn't want to go into the business in the first place. But back to your original question, yeah, we wanted to do it differently, and we wanted to try and do as much as we could in the UK. At the time, nobody else was doing that apart from Roger Smith.
Now, fast forward to the present day, I have a few questions about your business model, starting with whether you work through third-party dealers or sell everything direct, and why you made that choice.
We do literally 95% direct. We have a couple of private dealers that we deal with. We sell through the limited edition in the UK, Pietro. He deals with a lot of independent brands. He's got a lot of clients in Saudi. And UAE, which is a good market for us. But no, it works for us to do that because I like to deal with every client directly. I answer every single email, I answer every message from the website, I deal with all the problems. You know, we've got deals in the office, but I deal with absolutely everything. And I do a lot of Skype calls with clients. And to be honest, I think that's the best model for any independent. That if people have got that personal touch with the people behind the brand, they feel part of the brand, and that's kind of the way it's always been our business model from day one, and I don't think we're ever going to change that. Oh, there is another good reason, a damn good reason. We've literally got no margins for retailers. So our margins are so low, incredibly low, and we don't have 40% in a watch, basically.
How did you reach out during COVID? It seems acting direct and working remotely, not a whole lot would have changed for you.
No, because we did that anyway. So we our workshops are in Norwich. I live in Devon. I travel quite often. Well, I did before lockdown. I used to travel quite often to Norwich, but it's a 7-hour drive for me, so and a journey from hell. Believe me, I absolutely hated driving there. So during lockdown, when it first started, I was talking to quite a few other brands, and we were all scared, every single one of us. There's a good friend of mine, Nick, who I think you know at Fears. I remember talking to him at the time, and both of us were in a little bit of a panic, thinking, what on earth is going to happen? A few months went by, it was a little bit quiet, but all of a sudden the bubble burst, and then we all had orders flooding in. It seemed that everybody was sat at home, money burning a hole in the pocket, and wanting to buy things online. So it was a massive thing for us, but nothing really changed in the fact I've always done Zoom calls from day one, always done Skypes from day one, and we've always operated remotely. You know, we operate on a VoIP phone system, so if people can speak to me in Devon, and they can ring the main number in Norwich, and we pass calls back and forth. So, and it's a good role model. And as I was saying to you earlier before we went online, the even in my home, I've got an extension with a showroom, a full blown showroom. So and it's like a big office with all the watches there, the whole lot. So nothing's any different, and it worked perfectly for us. It's a good model.
Now, a lot of independents have different ways of responding to growth and success. You're an entrepreneur, and so you're doing about, am I right, 50 watches a year?
Well, we're more now. We have increased production, but we're building by hand, so we literally can't build them any faster. It's as simple as that. It's as fast as we can make the dials, as fast as we can polish the cases, as fast as we can engineer the parts. Yeah.
And so do you think of success in terms of the number of watches sold, or do you have some other way to set your goals?
We don't look at it that way. We're quite a large business as such, and we have so a little bit of our working model is we have three workshops. One's a clock workshop, so we do a lot of clock repairs and refurbishments and tower clocks and things like that. Then we've got a middle workshop where we do a bit of work for other brands, assembly and stuff like that, which and we do warranty and work, and then we've got the main Garrick workshop. We're building another second Garrick workshop at the moment, but that's the kind of thing we do in the background. So we don't rely too much on the sales. The overall business is what we think about more than anything, but it's Garrick that's kind of taking over now completely and utterly. We're streamlining things at the moment. We've took people out of other departments and now put them onto Garrick, and we've got a new girl, Esme, who started with us, and she's doing the dial assembly along with my partner Simon, and Craig's doing the main watch assembly and the engineering. So we've got three people at any one time now working on Garrick watches, but for ages it was just Craig and Simon doing the prototyping, and we couldn't ever build more than 50 watches per year. It was totally impossible. But the other issue is we've always had a waiting list, so the waiting list is forever and a day, which caused another problem. We were never able to build stock for ourselves ever, because we were constantly building watches for other people. So this is the first year, believe it or not, 2021, where we've ever had watches in our both showrooms. It's crazy for a watch brand.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole lot going on. And you mentioned that there are other branches within Garrick, but you've got another venture, which is the Watchmakers Club.
Yeah.
And what role does the Watchmakers Club play in promoting Garrick and other independent brands?
A hell of a lot. We put shows on. We're not able to do anything last year. We had a big one planned last year with about 30 something brands, and we couldn't go ahead in the end because obviously lockdown. We're planning something in September this year, but it's a good role model. The way the Watchmakers Club works is we've basically put on events, and when a brand attends an event, it has to be an independent nine times out of ten, although we do like to introduce new brands. We find a really cool bar or restaurant somewhere in London, really nice cracking place, and we rent the whole venue out, security, everything for the night or the day. It's normally the day and the night. And then we split the money fairly between every single brand, so no brand pays any more than the other. Every brand that attends has to look exactly the same as the other, so there's no fancy glass cases, anything. It doesn't matter if you're Fabergé, who have attended three or four times, or Schwartz Etienne, Chapek. You just come in, you lay your watches down on the table. We have a little sign for the brand on the table. We have a leather watchmaker's mat, which they lay the watches out on, and a little desktop case, and that's it. And then it cuts out all the industry snobbery, and that's the way we do it. So when we put a free bar on all night for everybody, and that's kind of the format. So all the collectors come in, they literally drink till the heart's content, meet one-on-one with the brand owners and the watchmakers behind the brand. It's always the brand owners that attends nine times out of ten. And that's where we promote most of our watches. We Watchmakers Club event. So if we've got anything new, we specifically save it for the Watchmakers Club event. And the concept was just to promote independent brands in the UK. That's what the concept was, but it kind of grew and grew and grew. And now there's a massive waiting list of brands and a lot of people on the mailing list. There's about 4,000 people that have signed up for tickets and things, and now it's a lot of brands end up selling at the event, which was never a thing, but it's a cool event, and it works for us and it works for other brands.
Do you view this as the successor to Salon QP or something different?
It's a different format. I mean, it has, people have tried to replicate it. We were the first to do it many years ago because this, everyone said to me at the time when I set the thing up, they all said, you'll never do it. You'll never get brands talking and communicating. And I kind of proved everybody wrong. Everybody did turn up, and it was a little bit difficult. There, some brands couldn't get over the concept that they just had to lay their watches down like everybody else, and they wanted to be bigger than. But they attended, absolutely loved it, seeing how friendly it was. You see, when you get rid of all that snobbery in the business, it's that one-on-one thing, and people are more inclined to come over and speak about your watches and want to see your watches, try them on, and more inclined to buy because they've got that one-on-one relationship with you. When you go to a lot of these large events, they stand with white gloves on, stand behind glass cases with their arms behind the backs, and people are scared to go up and talk to them. And we kind of cut through all that, and you know, that's why it works. And it was a brilliant thing, and I've missed it the last year. Frankly, it's been a nightmare not doing it because it's such good fun for everybody, and we have brands travel from all over the world.
Now, skewing back to Garrick, we'll talk about the Watchmakers Club again in a moment. But with Garrick, you spend quite a bit of time on fabrication and finishing. And as you said, you do build a lot in-house. So how much lead time do you typically need for an order, given how few watches you make? How many weeks goes into a Garrick watch?
It's normally 4 months. We can't really do anything faster, sometimes 3, normally 4. We do everything in batches of 5. We literally can't do any more than that. So if we do a set of bridges for a movement, if we do a set of dials, it's always 5 at any one time. Simon will do the engineering on the dials, for instance. He's my partner and watchmaker. He does the engineering on the dials, the plating and everything else. Craig will do the actual assembly and the testing. And then although as well as the workshop, we've got a dedicated polishing room, we've got a dedicated plating room. So it's a proper setup. We don't do everything in one workshop. And we've got a linishing room where we do all the cases and things like that with all the proper extraction. So we've got another guy, Carl, he literally does all the polishing. So Carl polishes the cases, Simon does the dials and everything like that, and Craig does the assembly, as I said. But it's the dials that actually take the time, believe it or not. That's where most of the complex work is, especially on the S4, which is massive at the moment. It's an extremely complex dial to build. As we have to make the dial blanks from scratch, rivet the feet on, then polish the rivets down on top. Then we have to finish the dials. The S4 has a guilloche dial, so that's the engine turned, plated, and then the chapter ring is really complex. It's engraved and then it's infilled with ink, so we do no printing of any kind. It's actually, we have a little syringe and Simon sits there with a syringe injecting every marker with ink, and then we have to spin the ink off. That's how complex it is to do a single dial.
I mean, it sounds a lot like a Roger Smith dial, to be honest.
It's crazy, and funny enough, when the S4 is the watch we always wanted to build. That's the one from day one, but it's such a complex build. If you understand it, you'll know what I mean. But there's so many aspects to that watch, and we tried everything for 9 months to bring it in on price. And believe it or not, we could have charged 10,000-15,000 for that watch, and people would have paid it, no hassle. But me and Simon have always had a goal. We're just normal guys. We're like normal watch collectors. And our goal from day one is to make high-end watchmaking affordable. We've not wanted to do anything else. So we were toying with the idea for ages what price point to put it, and I wanted it under 10k, and that proved nigh on impossible for months. So we made compromises. You wouldn't think about it looking at the actual watch, but we did make compromises, and I wanted to bring it in around the 5-6k mark. And you said yourself in the past that it's crazy money, and it absolutely is. But the profit margins, honestly, it's virtually non-existent. And you might think it's not a very good business model, but introducing the S4 introduces to a whole bunch of new customers who ordered S2s, S3s. And so it's had a knock-on effect for us. But you know, bringing it in on price was an absolute nightmare. And you know, as I've said, we just wanted to put it on the wrists of collectors and make it affordable as we could to everybody. And I think we achieved that goal, frankly.
Are customization options available? Because I know independents either say yes or hard no.
Actually, that's a nightmare, Tim, to be honest. We the worst thing you can ever do as a watch brand is advertise that you do bespoke, and because every single person that orders a watch wants a bespoke watch. And so that's another thing that increases the build time incredibly. So yeah, there's so many options on an S4. You can have a rhodium movement, a gold movement, a light rhodium, a dark rhodium, so dark gray, silver. On the dial, you can have it gold, pink gold, dark gray, yellow gold, galvanic treatments such as blue, green, red. That's all bespoke options. You can have the hands. So we heat blue our hands, as you know. So we heat blue the hands. We've had quite a few customers lately want them purple, and trying to get steel to purple at the right time is a bit of a job and a half. So we can do different coloured inks on the chapter rings, and there's various options. A lot of people go for fancy engraving. We're building a bespoke, it's called a Nelson tribute S2 for a client in America at the moment who wants a Nelson inscription on the dial, and we've had to heavily engrave the balance cock, which is normally skeletonized. We've done the dial in pink gold with a load of fancy engraving. It's actually been quite a good build, and we like doing stuff like that. But the issue you get is you get a lot of clients, and rightly so, because we offer the service, who want to change something, but then it's like, and you sign it off, and then literally, can you do this? And we're always polite and very kind people, so we say yes to absolutely everything. But then when it gets to like the 10th or 11th time, then I have to turn around and say, hang on a moment, you're going to create a bit of a Franken watch. And it's easily done, because the more you can change, the more you will change. And literally, you end up kind of designing a watch that you didn't fall in love with in the first place. And that's my whole point with bespoke. If you keep it simple, it works. If you go over the top, it doesn't. You're literally building something that you never, ever saw. And a lot of people approach us because they love the S4, and they end up creating something that doesn't look like an S4 anymore. That's the problem.
It's a very strong core design, and I think that's true for all your watches. So I'm just wondering, given that you do pay a lot of deference to tradition, are there any watchmakers past or present or styles that have influenced your designs, things you found inspirational as you
work? Absolutely. I'm a massive, massive fan of the Groenefelds. Absolutely love everything they do. Saab and Eva, another one. I love anything Daniels did. I love that. Because Daniels was obviously inspired by Breguet, and I love those Breguet type watches. It's, you know, it's anything like that's been an inspiration for us. And I always look at other brands, but we like to do things unique and have our own unique take on things. It's like when we did the S4. There's a lot of engine turn dials that look similar, but the first one we did was the Frosted dial. So we went for the Breguet type and Daniels type chapter ring with the frosted center. We had heavily frosted just to make it a little bit different. We obviously did the 3/4 bridge on the movement with the engraved barrel plate, which was totally unique, again, inspired by old English pocket watches and things like that. So we just tried to put our own spin on things, but I didn't want to change the S4 too much, because I've always liked those type of watches, and I think most people do. They've got like a handmade nature to them, and that's what I like. But I like a lot of independents inspire me, frankly, and I like, you know, there's a lot of larger brands like Lange. I love their stuff. Andrea Strehler is a good friend of mine. I love everything the man does. But I'm, like I say, the my biggest inspiration without any doubt is probably the Groenefelds, their role model, everything they've done with the brand, amazing, absolutely amazing.
Now, you mentioned a man whose association...
Oh, sorry, one more person I've got to mention, Shapiro, absolutely, without any doubt.
Thank you, you get the American in there, I appreciate that.
No, absolutely, I forgot, and he's been a massive inspiration to me, really.
Very cool. So you mentioned Andreas Strehler, and a lot of folks are very impressed that you have a business relationship with him for movement design. Could you describe that relationship a little bit, how it came about and what it encompasses?
Well, Andreas is a friend. I've known him for many years, and we're more friends than anything else. We speak all the time. We talk about anything, films, we're just like normal people. But we're, we obviously talk about business, obviously, because we're running businesses. And I approached him when we were doing the original movement design for the S2. And he came on board via Ertile, which is his engineering company. So it's all via Ertile. And then we went through them and put something together. And it's not only that, there's Andreas and a lot of watchmakers that have actually helped us over the years. If ever I need advice, I'm not afraid to pick up the phone. And back to Peter Roberts. who's been a great inspiration. When I first started the run, I went to Peter for a lot of advice. Shall I do this? What do you think about doing that? How can we do this? How can we make this more efficient? And Peter's a really, really accomplished watchmaker and a really, really good friend of mine. Honestly, I can't say enough about the guy. He's so highly respected and he's kind of retired now. And, he was a massive help to us. So I've always had people in the background that I can pick up the phone to. It's never been an issue for me. And believe me, we encounter problems like any other brand, but, I'm not afraid to email somebody. I'm not afraid to ring. What's the worst thing? Say no. If we're stuck, pick up the phone.
So now, Urteil, of course, is Andreas Trailer's sort of engineering house that assists
other
brands.
Yeah.
Is that sort of what you're doing with Garrick Lab, or is that a different intent?
Yeah, Garrick Lab, we do a lot of work with other brands. So it's kind of hush-hush with that, and it kind of sits in the background. And it kind of sits in the background. We don't really advertise it. We do design work with a few other brands and a bit of assembly and a few secret projects that we're working on, which I'm not allowed to say. But basically, we're doing some work for two or three other brands, which is engineering work and design. That's kind of what we do with Garrick Lab. We were going to bring another range of watches out via Garrick Lab, something a little bit crazy, because obviously the other brand I've got to mention are a massive inspiration to me, at MB&F, Max Booster. What can I say? I love everything they're doing. And we wanted to kind of use that as a role model and do something, not copying in any way, shape or form, but do something a little out there. And we never kind of got round to it. We were that engaged with other work, we just never did it. But that's another brand yet again that are a massive, massive inspiration.
So now I understand your inspirations and admired brands, precedents that you like to follow, things that you might draw from. But there's always the future. And I'm curious, what kind of styles or watch features would you like to explore in the future at Garrick?
Well, watches, as you know, are more traditional than anything else, apart from the regulator, even that's unique for a regulator. So we like to do our own take on things. We've been looking at doing a sports watch of some kind. Simon, my partner, wants to do a dive watch. I don't think it really fits in with the brand, frankly, but you never know. We might end up doing it. He absolutely wants to do one. He built a prototype some years back, and I'll have to show it you one day. It's a massive, huge 1,000 meter depth dive watch that he built using the lathes and everything. And it's so industrial when you look at it, but it's one of the first watches he ever did, and he wants to do something similar because he's into anything like that. I'd rather go down the sports model route and do something a little bit out there, but we haven't really come up with a concept at the moment, to be honest. We're launching the S5 at the end of the year. That's the latest model, and you're probably the first person to know that, which is a new in-house caliber, and big news, it's the one that everybody's been asking for. It's 39 mil. That's the one that everybody's been asking for years. And obviously, as you know yourself, the movement dictates the case size, and our movement's a 16 line movement. So, we've never been able to do it before.
Oh, certainly. And I've noticed a couple of interesting things about the way you sort of stand behind your watches. You're doing things that a lot of other companies, even independents, aren't doing. 5-year warranties. And on some of your movements, you're actually quoting an accuracy of plus 3 seconds a day.
Yeah.
Very few brands want to talk about accuracy. You're one of the
only. Well, no, nobody does it. And funnily enough, I was told by everybody at the time, don't ever do it. And they've got a point, because it's so variable on any watch. And it is. So many things influence the timing. And we did it, but the only problem is with that, Tim, it has a bit of a knock-on effect on the build, because we build the watch, it literally can be ready on time, and then we've got to try and get the timing right, and to get it to plus three is extremely difficult, especially if we're using a Unitas base, and it takes weeks literally to do it. It's not an easy job, because when you put we're building the movements from scratch. You're not buying a kit in. You're modifying the bridges and everything else. And, you get end shape and all kinds of things. The escapement, the gear train, all these things have an influence on the timing. And to get it to plus three and keep it accurate is the hardest part. That's without a doubt the hardest part. Sometimes I regret ever doing it. But we've said it, and now we do it. And we do it with every single one. But honestly, it's one of those things that I kind of regret actually ever doing, because it's the setup that's the nightmare, frankly. But it's what makes us different, as you said. That's why we do it.
That's very cool because, again, there are brands that are a million times your size that they just want to say the craftsmanship is beautiful. It looks great. They don't want to talk about accuracy.
And rightly so. Rightly so, because like I say, there's so many things influence it. It's a fact. It can be a nightmare because, honestly, you wouldn't think it, but we have clients that literally buy the watch and the first thing they do is put it on a timing machine as soon as they get it.
Yeah, people, but all your customers are going to be weird in this industry. There's some.
Well, I know, and that's the thing. Fair play to them, but you know, we're watchmakers, and it's hard getting the message out. Sometimes there's so many things that influence the timing, and you can check the timing in various ways, and it's always going to read different for somebody else. And don't forget the other point is it's worth mentioning. We use manual wind movements, and as the movement's winding down, obviously you haven't got a constant force. So all these things have an influence, and there's a reason brands don't quote it, and it's a damn good reason. That's all I'm saying.
Well, from a collector's perspective, I applaud you, and also from a collector's perspective. Do you still collect watches? Do you have a collection that you keep?
Yeah, I've got a massive collection of watches. Yeah, absolutely.
Few favorites you could share with us?
Yeah, I've got loads of favorites. My all-time favorite, the watch that I would never sell, which is my Grail watch, is a watch that Peter Roberts did. It was called the Concentrate. And just a little bit of a background, if we've got time, about Peter Roberts. Yeah. He was at Wostep many, many years ago. Then he went into, he worked at Rolex in a little secret department there doing bespoke watches. There's a lot of bespoke Rolex out there that people don't know that. And that's what he was doing in Rolex. He was the head watchmaker at Rolex. He worked at Bremont when Bremont first started. He did the development on the Martin Baker and watches like that. He trained Peter Speaks, Stephen Forsey, my partner Simon, because he was a teacher for a long time. Anyway, he always had a watch on his wrist for many years that he built. You know, the Wostep project watches, when you finish at Wostep, everybody has to build a watch. And yes, at the time, it was many, many years ago, he wanted to build a five-handed watch, which was a GMT function date and everything else. And at the time, it had never been done. And the teacher said, you won't be able to do it. It's so simple now. A lot of brands have done it. But at the time, it hadn't been done. So he proved them wrong. He actually built this watch and he called it the Concentrique. And it's got the Wostep dial on it with, and it's so cool, made out of like Daytona case and things like this. And that's what it was built from. And he wore it on his wrist for years and years. And everybody always wanted it. And everybody saw it on his wrist and everybody wanted that watch and they would never sell it ever. It's such a cool looking watch, really. And then literally some years back, he was convinced when he left Bremont to actually build a series, and he built a series of 24 watches, I think it was, and it was a modern kind of update on the existing watch using a Valjoux 81, vintage Valjoux 81 movement, I think it was the 81, and it's the most coolest watch ever. And literally I was working with him at the time, and that's what I was doing at QP when I met my partner. I was promoting the watch with him because I contacted him and said, listen, Peter, I think you need a little bit of help. And he said, oh, Dave, you have no idea. And we became really good friends, been on a cruise together and everything. He's such a nice guy. But, you know, that was the watch, and I managed to get number two. So someone beat me to number one, I got number two. And that's my holy grail watch. I would never, ever sell it. And strangely enough, everybody knows I've got this watch. And a lot of collectors, even Garrick buyers, I've got the guy that did the Nelson tribute. At the moment, he's begged me to sell my Concentrique because everybody wants one. I've had people contact me from Asia. Everybody wants the watch. It's just so cool. But there was only 20 something ever made. So that's my first one. I've got a Zeitwinkel 273, which I absolutely love. Zeitwinkel, really good friends of mine. Not many people know about the brand, but they're kind of Lange quality at a third of the price, and they're stunning watches, absolutely stunning watches. The 273 has a large date like a Lange. I've got a Lange 1 in the collection. I've got some vintage Rolexes, quite a few vintage Rolexes. And another one of my favourite watches is my vintage Rolex GMT Pepsi from 1968 with the plexiglass. I absolutely love that watch to bits. And it's the watch I wore for years and years and years, to be honest. But I've got watches from all brands. I've got watches at £500. I've got watches all the way up to 100 grand. It's you name it, and I've kind of got it. I'll wear anything. I'll buy it because I like it, and there's no other reason.
So I want to make sure all of our listeners out there in cyberspace know Dave Brailsford is one of us. There is no doubt.
Absolutely. And that's another reason, like I say, I answer all the emails and phone calls. I won't let anybody else deal with it. I'm a collector. I want to make sure everybody's happy. I'm a normal guy. I go out drinking like everyone else, probably a bit heavier than most people. I'm a big real ale fan, so I like my bitter and my whiskey. That's the kind of how I chill out on my days off. I'm just a normal guy. Anyone that's met me will tell you the same. If a customer's unhappy, it makes me unhappy. And like I say, I'll buy a watch. If it's a couple of £100, I'll buy it. If it's whatever, it doesn't matter to me. I've got Christopher Ward in my collection, numerous brands, Opinion in my collection, which is a British brand, you name it, I've kind of got it.
So now if folks, as we sort of reach the end, if folks want to find you online or offline, obviously the Watchmakers Club is going to be doing live events again soon. COVID's winding down. Could you also talk about like your online presence where people can reach out and get in touch if they want to talk watches?
Well, anybody can contact me. I've got my personal Facebook page. I tend to keep my personal life a little bit. I know a lot of the brand owners don't. They put everything online. I like keep it a little bit separate, to be honest. So I don't put anything that I do online. But I answer every single email. My phone is on the website. My phone's on my email, so people can ring me. I talk to people, Tim, all night long till literally, as you know, America, different time. I'm talking till 1 o'clock in the morning, most mornings, on Skype, on Zoom. People can contact me via the website. I answer even on the chat on the website. It's me that answers. I answer absolutely everything. There's girls in the office don't do it. Simon doesn't do it. It's me. So they can contact me via the normal standard email, by my mobile number, the landline. And I'm always there. And I'm always happy to talk. Believe me, I'll chat away for hours, hours and hours.
And they can DM you on Instagram?
Yeah, absolutely. DM, it's me that answers the Instagram. We do have someone else that does it every now and again from the office, but I answer everything personally. It's always me. So, that's the way I prefer it, to be honest. And like I say, I'm a normal guy. I like to chat watches, not just Garrett things. And most of the time I end up talking to a client. That's what we're doing. We're talking about each other's collections. And it's interesting to find out what other people have got in the collections.
And for those of us who are in the UK, when can we plan to see the next exhibition by the Watchmakers Club?
So hopefully September, either the end of September, beginning of October. It's a little bit difficult now, as you can imagine, because we're not sure about quarantining with various countries, but hopefully towards the end of the year, definitely.
All right. Dave Brailsford, thank you so much. And for all of our friends out in cyberspace, please check out Garrick Watches on Instagram, check them out on their website, and feel free to reach out because Dave loves to chat.
Thanks very much, Tim. Nice to speak to you. And thanks to everybody for listening.